Welcome aboard. Today on Water Bodies, anchor Matuma is sitting down with Eli Entz and Suda Jamshidian, both from the Itzhakolam Foundation. They're experts in this field of IPCAs, or Indigenous Protected and Conserved Areas, which is a unique designation for a conservation area that we have here in Canada, and one that Eli himself was actually involved with creating. They'll be talking about everything from the problematic history of conservation under colonization and bringing this kind of multi-layered perspective on jurisdictions and laws, both human and natural. They'll discuss this idea of the ethical space and why it matters. And finally, Eli has a proposal for how we could fund ecological integrity here in False Creek. So stick around, because today we're talking about conservation through reconciliation. Let's take the plunge.
Alrighty, welcome to the Water Bodies podcast. I guess just to get things started off, we love to ask our guests to introduce themselves by way of a water body that they connect with most. So I'd pass on that question to the both of you. What's sort of the water body that you have the deepest relationship with, and what's the story behind that connection?
Ladies first.
Sure.
Take it away.
A very interesting question. I'm originally from Iran. I'm half Persian, half Turkish. And my roots just come from the deserts. And our water body has traditionally been mostly ganats or karis, which was this structure of interconnected wells that would bring underground water for thousands of kilometers to create towns and cities in the middle of the desert and do agriculture in them and all of that. Just this really wonderful question really got me thinking. I was like, from my childhood, I don't have a lot of memories of the water because I grew up in a big city. I grew up in Tehran. Didn't have a lot of that connection. I got to go to the village and see the life of my ancestors and my people with the land. And there was no water body there either. It was just, there were ganats that people talked about. And when I learned about them, I was just really in awe by, wow, this is incredible. And about 18 years ago, life brought me here to this gorgeous city, to Vancouver. And really, this water body here, False Creek, is where I really got like connected to the ocean. It's such a blessing to live in a place that there is a water body in it. And it's something that I really think about. And something really special about False Creek is also that you can see the vast and big ocean, Pacific Ocean, from here. And from my childhood, I was always just, it was one of my dreams to see the Pacific Ocean. So just like life bringing me here and keeping me here for this last 18 years has been a blessing. So I would say this is partially my water body. And then the underground waters of the deserts of the Middle East is also my water body. Yeah, thanks for that question.
Yeah, that's a very special response. Thank you so much. Yeah,
it's beautiful. My knee-jerk reaction was to talk about the river, the Assiniboine River in Manitoba, where I, on my mom's side of my family, grew up. And what's beautiful about the Assiniboine River, it's ever-changing. You know, it's always flowing, and it feels like it's eternal. Some might think the Pacific Ocean. My father's side of my family is from the west coast of Vancouver Island. And he was born on the ocean, and he died on the ocean. He died in 2009 at Ogden Point. But I guess what I would play the devil's advocate for a moment, and my body of water is in a plastic bottle that is discarded. It's the water's still inside there, and it's discarded, and who knows when it's going to be reunited with the ocean. And unfortunately, that's how I feel from time to time. Being urbanized, and living in my own concrete jungle, colonization, whatnot. So I'm like the body of water inside a plastic bottle.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Quite an answer.
Yes, quite an answer. I think it's important that you mentioned that as well, because when it comes to spaces like False Creek and sort of seeing the amount of human population but activity that occurs around this space, pollution and just water management and taking care of the water is something that always comes up. Part of that conversation has been sort of geared towards conservation and stewardship. And acknowledging that False Creek has a very rich and diverse history, particularly with connections to Indigenous communities. I was wondering if you could maybe both touch on how those ideas of conservation and stewardship have differed historically on this land, so particularly with Indigenous communities and settlers.
The conventional concept of conservation comes from a disconnected worldview. Same thing with an industrial landscape. Comes from a disconnected worldview. They're two extremes, but they come from the same world of seeing things in pieces, humanity separate from nature, Christians separate from Muslims, Black people separate from white people, the gender divides, all this cascading disconnectedness. But the first thing is how we disconnect ourselves from nature. And so conventional conservation is actually very dysfunctional in so much that it understands human beings separate from nature. And I always go back to the little Cree elder from Edmonton in 2010, and he said to me, we don't have a word in our language. In the Cree language, we don't have a word for conservation. We just have the way we live our lives. And the way they live their lives was through biomimicry, in social innovation, in observing what happens in nature and emulating that in human human society, human economy, whatnot. So conventional conservation is very disconnected and dysfunctional, and it's part of the problem, to be, 100% brutally honest on that one.
Yeah, I feel conservation is a very loaded word. And I did not realize it as someone who just loved nature. And when you go to school and learn about nature, the idea of conservation sounds amazing, right? Because we are all just like, oh, everybody's just using all the resources. And I want to be one of the people who is taking care of it for future generations. And I want to be able to spend more time in nature. And for me, just the day I learned how unfair conservation was and the histories of it just really comes from separating humans from nature. It's based on the Yellowstone National Park in the United States and nature sanctuaries in the UK that were really just about cutting a piece of land, pretending humans are not a part of this, and taking care of it for the rich people at the beginning, and then also then offering it to the middle class people of the city to come and enjoy it, taking it away from the people that it really belongs to them. And for me, also social justice has been one of my really core values. So it was just really crazy to see how these are just so disconnected in a way. And you use the word stewardship, and it really caught me because you're thinking about conservation, it's really cutting off the stewardship from the people who are really stewards of these lands. It's pretending that these ecosystems exist this way without humans, like thinking the pristine exists as if there are no people ever there. And it's just not true. Even like now we're talking about these little communities in the middle of jungle in Brazil that have never had connection to the outside world. And for us being the outside world, we're like, wow, they're so remote. For them, they're not. They're just living their lives in their environment. And that's just the reality. It's just painful to think about it that way because so many people have had pain with it. I've had conversations with, especially like Indigenous people in Canada, that just their land was just taken away from them. Their lives, like they were just kicked out of where their home is. Like we really are our lands. We are like our nature. We are, it is just a part of us. And it's just this idea of separating humans from nature, then thinking we're better than nature and giving our names to it instead of like so many indigenous groups in North America, they got their names from nature. It's just like a very different way of seeing nature and thinking about conservation. So I want to just bring this up for a moment to think about it this way. What it means to be a steward of a land. You come, take it away from other people who were stewarding it for thousands of years and be like, oh, now I take care of it for you. And don't even ask how they did it. Like, that's the absurd part of this whole system. Take a moment and think about it. I think if anyone who's been in the depths of nature and spent some time with themselves and the Mother Earth, there you go, I abuse this word. Knows that there's something there in your connection with nature. And this just didn't happen because some people in the 1900s created protected areas. This existed forever. It's inherent to our being as humans to be a part of nature.
I really appreciate both of you bringing up those points on justice, of course, and indigeneity and how it relates back to conservation and stewardship efforts. But I also sort of think about how we can restructure this line of thinking, more particularly within the framework of IPCAs. So maybe we could take a step back and maybe define what an IPCA is for members of the audience that might be a bit unfamiliar with the concept. And maybe you could share on how using that model of conservation or stewardship could help us with bridging some of those disconnects between human and nature, or amplifying some of those voices that are needed for social justice efforts within the space of conservation.
I think I'm going to pass this question to you, Eli. Yeah. Eli is the person who has worked on IPCAs in Canada from day one. We met before IPCAs were a word because we were working on this topic in other parts of the world. And I think this journey of where this word came from, IPCAs, is just a really beautiful one to hear. And I want to pass it to Eli.
That's today, in 2013, late Tagi Favor introduced me to her. And back then we were talking about ICCAs, which is, back then Indigenous Peoples and Community Conserved Territories and Areas. Now I think they call it Territories of Life or something, mm-hmm. Trying to make it more relatable. Everyone's struggling with acronyms. And so these two acronyms came together, the ICAs and the IPAs. And I'll take responsibility for coining the term IPCAs here in Canada, Indigenous Protected and Conserved Areas. It's a stopgap measure. It's not the solution. And I think of Lisa Young from Unamagi on the west, the east coast of Canada, the Mi'kmaq people. She said that IPCAs could and should be beacons of teachings, where we have places, watershed level places, where we exercise and demonstrate good relationships, not only among human beings, but with nature itself. And so that's what IPCAs could be. Let us not follow the dysfunctional standards and models that we've been tripping over our shoelaces for too long with that regard. And anyways, Sude, maybe you have something to add to that.
Yeah, I think I'm just going to say a little bit like where this conservation with Indigenous peoples came from. That could be an interesting thing to discuss. So Eli mentioned ICCAs, Indigenous and Community Conserved Areas and Territories. So before 2001, IUCN, International Union for Conservation of Nature, they only had one kind of conservation governance. When they talked about a protected area, it meant that the federal or central government, basically, or provincial government in countries like Canada, was creating the parks and managing them, like had the power over managing them. Until in 2001, with the work of so many Indigenous people and their allies in academia and NGOs and such, this changed. So IUCN created governance types. So besides the management categories they had for nature reserves and national parks and areas of conserved nature, they then created governance types, which then got conservation by the government or governance by the government or central government was one of them. Another one was private lands. Another one was co-managed. And the fourth kind was indigenous protected and indigenous conserved areas, basically, or ICCAs. And that even didn't pick up in the world, even though these like new policy guidelines came along in 2001. It wasn't until 2010 that CBD, conventional biological diversity, happened in Aichi in Japan, and it put in new targets that increased the level of conservation that each government had to conserve. Before that, it was 10% of the terrestrials or areas or lands that governments need to conserve, and 5% of marine areas and waters. Then this level increased to 17% of terrestrial areas and 7% of marine areas for each country to conserve of its lands. That triggered basically governments to go identify other areas that are conserved by, that are now identified as different governance types, and add them to their networks of protected areas. That's kind of like why this got bigger. Because governments wanted, it's expensive to create new protected areas, right? But government wanted to create these, but it's cheaper to just go find areas that people are already conserving and add it to your network. So that's where it becomes really important to support indigenous groups and the work that they're doing so that they don't lose their powers in these negotiations with the government. This is just really real. And like what Eli said, like in Canada, they approached him. Parks Canada approached Eli and asked, hey, what do Indigenous people want it to look like? That went into creation of the Indigenous Circle of Experts that Eli created and co-chaired with Danica Littlechild. And they had meetings all over the country in Canada and defined these guidelines and policy recommendations for Indigenous-led conservation and for Indigenous conservation to succeed in Canada. And one thing that really touched me about that work, that report, which is called ICE Report or Indigenous Circle of Experts Report, was that they called it We Rise Together. And like, go ask people, hey, how do we do this? And it's like, oh, we do it together. And that's why, like when Eli said, this is a model of us humans connecting to one another, different jurisdictions connecting to one another with Indigenous sovereignty and like good Canadian government and such, and us connecting to nature. That's just what makes it really special about IPCAs. And that word ICCAs that is like used internationally in the world is like a piece of this. Like it's the Canada has really defined it specifically for the context of Canada, which is just really special because Indigenous peoples created it. And for the rest of the world, for Indigenous people, this is also a very special opportunity because this is a place that Indigenous nations are really practicing this sovereignty in different ways. So just wanted to bring this piece up. It's more complicated, so much more complicated in a place like False Creek, which is in the middle of the city, because you've got so many different jurisdictions. It's not just federal government and one Indigenous nation. We have so many different parties involved.
No, and so just to pick up on that point, I guess, if we were to sort of look at False Creek and what it would take to set up a model of an IPCA here in an urban marine setting, is that even feasible? Is that a possibility?
So a big part of it is layers of jurisdiction. So when you look from the sky down on the land, sometimes it's easy just to see the surface. See, the surface here is maybe it's a municipal jurisdiction, but underneath, when you look at the layers of jurisdiction, you have provincial, federal, and constitutional. Just to wrap up the whole, what is in an IPCA? Jack Woodward was our lawyer. So back in 1985, after the Mears Island Tribal Park Declaration, we went to court. The Mears Island court case in 1985, Jack Woodward was a young aspirational lawyer at the time. And he went on to become one of the sort of premier thought leaders, lawyer, legal minds in Indigenous law, Canadian law regarding Indigenous people. And he was interviewed by the Norwal probably 15 years ago now, maybe it's 10. But he said, you know, for the average person to understand what a tribal park is, they can think about it as a constitutional park. So 1982, Canada patriated its constitution from the United Kingdom. creating a domestic amending formula for our own constitution. And before that, it was called the British North American Act of 1867. Now in 1982, you have the Canada Act of 1982. And in that was included Section 35. Section 35 recognized and affirmed pre-existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. It didn't create anything new. That's a really important distinction. Section 35 recognized pre-existing Aboriginal and treaty rights that go all the way back to the Treaty of Fort Niagara in 1764, the King George's Royal Proclamation of 1763 were some of the early semblances of Canadian constitutional law. So when Indigenous peoples declare IPCAs, they're actually exercising constitutional jurisdiction. So if you go anywhere in Canada and you, for example, to be melodramatic, if you commit murder, it doesn't matter what jurisdiction you're in. If you're on municipal land, provincial land, whatever, that's a violation of federal criminal law. If you go and you create a restaurant and you say only, let's say, men are allowed to, I don't know, or white people or whatever, it's a violation of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. The Constitution is everywhere. And I'm talking about layers of jurisdiction. If a municipality violates federal law, provincial law, or constitutional law, they're, just because you have superficial ownership, fee simple ownership of a little piece of property somewhere, that doesn't mean you're above all these other layers of jurisdiction. And so Indigenous law is activated through Section 35 of the Canada Act of 1982. It's standalone. Indigenous law is standalone. So we live in a multinational state. It's not just French and English. There's many Indigenous laws across this country. They are standalone, valid on their own. But where they bridge into Canadian law is via Section 35 of the Canada Act of 1982, which recognizes and affirms pre-existing Aboriginal and treaty rights, and that underlies everything. And by the way, they don't care about terrestrial and marine divides. Constitutional law underlies everything. 200 nautical miles out, that's still our responsibility out there. And so, you know, that's where IPCAs come in. And for 100%, I mean, Vancouver's temporary. The cement, everything, all the buildings and whatnot, it's not going to be here forever. Our people look into the past, 500 years in the past, 500 years in the future. If you do not build things on sound foundations, it will not stand up. Here, if you build things on a creek, well, water will win. Eventually, water will win. And, you know, we have to either be victims of our own mismanagement, or we can start to adapt, you know, make better decisions. And I think that's the opportunity that we have with the Friends of False Creek and other civil society organizations that are trying to bring attention to the fact that, by golly, we've cemented over all these waterways. Well, one day it'll come back. So you either get on board now or wish you had when the disasters start to strike.
I think what I would add is, yes, it's very complicated for a place like False Creek. There are at least three Indigenous nations that this is their territory. There's a federal government involved even here, and the provincial government and the municipal government and all these companies that have lands. But something that has really I've learned in the last few years working with Indigenous peoples of Canada is thinking about rights and responsibilities. If we all come together, and not because, hey, this is my right to do this and this. And if we come together by wanting a clean, beautiful city, healthy city, wanting a space we can connect to nature and be a part of it in the middle of our city, which is, I'm just going to keep saying it because it's so special.
Yeah.
And I have a responsibility. I don't care what else is out there. And we all have that responsibility. All these groups I mentioned, all these people walking around False Creek, enjoying this beauty, this little jewel that we have in Vancouver, they all also they have a right and they have a responsibility towards it. So if we come together and look at it as our, all of us, our group responsibility to care for this, it's very complicated, but it's very possible at the same time. Because at the end of the day, this is our home. And I just want, I want to say like a story, like a few months ago, a few years ago now, we had an indigenous tour of False Creek that I got to attend. And we had Chief Bill Williams from Squamish Nation there. He told a little bit of the story of what happened to the Squamish Nation and how they were forced out of Sinuk, the village that was in the Granville Island area. And it is just atrocities that people went through. They were like basically kicked out of their land. They were brought barges and throw them in there. And then they gave them a bunch of money. Not, they didn't give consensus, just threw also the money on the barge and they left them there. And one of them swam and went and found like a white friend they had that could come carry them. And the person came and carried them to North Vancouver. That's how they were like kicked out of that land. Like, this is not a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And like, he tells this story, and then most of us on this tour were settlers. And it was a time that I was pregnant, just a few months. And so I'm like there listening to the story. And then he just looks at all of us and says, now you all live here. Welcome to this land. Now you're all Coast Salish people. Learn what it means to be a Coast Salish person. And I felt like a welcome for myself and my child there in that moment to be here and be allowed to call this my body of water, and felt a responsibility for it. And I think that's the thing. Like, we live in Vancouver. Why don't we learn about the languages of these people of this land? And like the systems they had for managing this very complicated water body. False Creek is not just this little thing. There were just so many creeks that connected to one another, this entire area. Some of them are closed now. And that's why sometimes we have really crazy floods in Vancouver area, right? And so we have so much to learn from the indigenous people of this land. We are also Coast Salish people, and we have a responsibility towards it. And I think if all of us think about it this way, it's not very difficult to get to consensus and want to care for our lands. It's not, I think it's just making that switch and having this conversation with everyone that this is my responsibility. I don't care what you think. A little bit of that.
Fist bump.
Absolutely. Something that stood out to me in both of your responses was that acknowledgement that there are a lot of levels of jurisdiction within this area, and sort of thinking about responsibility and who's able to act and engage and be a steward of this land. Are there any sort of complexities that sort of come up in sort of that process that disbar people from fully engaging because of all that jurisdiction and bureaucracy?
I think the one thing I left out of my comments was Mother Nature's jurisdiction. At the end of the day, Creator Mother Nature's jurisdiction is natural law. And I think about the people of Abbotsford as an example. In 2021, there was the so-called atmospheric rivers, and the unfortunate narrative that won the day was that was the fault of climate change. People said, "Oh, atmospheric rivers, more deluge." But when you talk to the people of Sumas and Chief Silver, I was there 15 years ago, and he said, that used to be a sturgeon lake, that all that area where Abbotsford is, that used to be a shallow sturgeon lake. And they had an abundant economy. And the lake was shallow. And so in the winter months, in the rainy season, it was expansive. In the summer, in the dry season, it got smaller. And when the newcomers came along, they saw, okay, well, in the lake bed, there's nutrient-rich soil that we can use for agriculture. And the old people who were alive at that time, the Sumas elders back 100 years ago, they said, by golly, don't build in there. Don't build houses in there. Don't farm in there. The lake will reestablish itself. And you know what they did? They used technology to artificially drain that lake continuously. And so there's a human-centric, egotistical idea that we can conquer nature, that we can manipulate the land and the water to suit our needs as human beings. And that's what they did in Abbotsford. And you know what? My heart goes out to all the people who are impacted. They're still suffering today. The land is still suffering of the environmental contamination that came with those floods. You know, another news story comes along. That was only 4 years ago. There's still impacts from all that fuel and all that agricultural, like the fertilizer, the pesticides, herbicides, all that stuff got washed away. It was catastrophic. But it was 100% predicted 100 years ago. So this is what I'm saying, is natural law will always win. You can try to outthink Mother Nature. You can try to outsmart her with your science and your technology, whatnot. But natural law will always win. So yeah, we have layers of jurisdiction. You have the surficial, fee simple British common law, provincial, you know, federal, constitutional. But you also have natural law. You have Mother Nature's law. And that coincides with Indigenous law, by the way, because Indigenous peoples, we've learned from Mother Nature over millennia. And so we try to emulate her teachings and her jurisdictions in our human relations. And so IPCAs, in a way, is a tack. It cuts through those layers and says, all right, let's try to have all these layers pay attention to Mother Nature's jurisdiction, to Creator's jurisdiction, and then use that as our anchor to make sure that we're on the right side of history and that our grandchildren may suffer less. Because unfortunately, our grandchildren will suffer. It's the genie's out of the bottle. There's a cascading series of effects, cause and effect, that is in place now. But we can kind of rein back and we can start to get on the right side of things by observing Mother Nature Creator's law. And IPCAs is just, you know, a modern day concept to come back to those fundamental foundational teachings and jurisdictions.
And so just maybe for my own clarity and understanding, would some of those jurisdictional boundaries still apply and exist if this area were to become an IPCA?
100%. Yep. In fact, they must. And you know, this is another misconception about IPCAs is that some people think that creating an IPCA eliminates all other, like we buy out tree farm licenses, mining tenures, municipal boundaries, whatnot, fee simple ownership. But ideally, an IPCA brings balance and for lack of a better word, harmony with those layers of jurisdiction with Mother Nature's Creator jurisdiction. We can scour them away, but at the end of the day, we're not learning our lesson in terms of how do we exercise fee simple ownership or provincial permit or tenure. How do we exercise that in a way that is actually harmonious with Indigenous law and Mother Nature Creator's law, kind of a deal? Anyways, you want to add something to that one?
I think you said it very well. I think the jurisdictions are there. It's more about collaboration and working with one another. Maybe an IPCA for False Creek would look like, it will look like a co-management between different groups of stakeholders and right holders, and Indigenous groups will and should play a very important role in that, the decision-making and the plan for this place. But everybody else exists, right? And will be a part of it.
Using that model, just the examples that you've mentioned, what might that look like on the ground here?
We'll be right back after this message from one of our environmental allies.
Hi, I'm Emma from the Small Planet Heroes podcast, where each episode we discuss what it takes to face today's systemic sustainability challenges with some of the most influential voices in Canada on the environment. Join us in conversations on pressing topics from Indigenous land governance to creating climate optimism and more. Small Planet Heroes is produced by CoSphere, a project out of the University of British Columbia's Vancouver campus. Find us on Small Planet Heroes wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Instagram at Small Planet Heroes to stay in touch.
what might that look like on the ground here? What would those consultations look like? How might we sort of gain support and galvanize the public to be involved in that process of consulting and connecting and sharing knowledge?
Well, the consultations would be just having different groups have contribute in making decisions for it. So it's like a co-management system. Well, our main right holders in my mind are the indigenous groups of this land, because we don't want to repeat what had happened before in False Creek. So learning about their vision for False Creek and learning about their knowledge of how it should be and what it looked like in its glory, learning from their languages, because indigenous languages hold a lot of knowledge. Just wanted to add something to this conversation. It's like that's one part of it. Let me just go there. I don't want to go on a crazy tangent. And then the people who live around False Creek, we all have rights to add to it, to what our vision is for False Creek and what we wanted. And then asking our city and our councillors to work towards that, and federal and provincial organizations who work on protected areas, different groups that provide funding and support this, being involved, being engaged in this decision making, and maybe having a committee of some sort that I think like works on these decisions and manages them. The thing is, this is a very difficult question to answer, so I'm just giving you generally what would happen in a co-management scenario, because I we are not designing it. We want the people who like the indigenous nations of False Creek to be a part of this decision making and like be a part of this visioning for us as settlers who care for False Creek and want to be a part of it. I think our role, especially as False Creek Friends Society, is as one of the civil society organizations to try to bring these groups together and get their words and be the voice for False Creek in a way. In some of the co-management processes that they've worked with indigenous groups, they have brought a person representing the resource to talk for the resource. So maybe being that voice for False Creek in a way. The first time I heard this was about this potato park in Peru, and they had a person sitting on the table representing the potatoes. And this is conversations between different indigenous nations that managed that park. There was no other people, but they made sure that potatoes and what they want is being protected. And so this might sound funny to us, but if you think about all of these as beings, I'm hoping there will be a person just sitting there representing False Creek and all the living that exists in it still today. Like we had like this photo shoot of underwater of False Creek and so much life that we found, didn't know it existed after all the pollution that had existed here. Every now and then we have orcas coming to visit us in False Creek. So that kind of, that gives me hope that there's still a place to think about the beauty of it coming up. So I just don't want to get into the weeds of how a co-management scenario has to look like. I'm just saying like, these are the ways it could look like.
From what I'm gathering and understanding, it appears there's a lot of prerequisites that sort of go into establishing either a co-management model or an IPC at large. One of the ones that I had come across was the idea of ethical spaces. Might you be able to sort of share what an ethical space is and how it ties back to the idea of IPCAs?
Okay, so Danica Littlechild, she was the co-chair of the Indigenous Circle of Experts for the Pathway to Canada Target 1. Sude mentioned earlier the Aichi targets. Aichi Target 11 was the 17% target. And so myself and Danica Littlechild co-chaired that committee. And at the very first meeting, I'm going to tap the table. At our very first meeting, she brought the teachings of Dr. Reg Croshu to the conversation. And Reg, like some other Indigenous scholars, had picked up this idea of ethical space. And it's really straightforward in a way. It's where different knowledge systems can come together, not one dominating the other, but come together in equality for complex problem solving. So in the case of the UNCBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, we employed this concept of ethical space in achieving the Aichi target 11. And so when I heard Reg Croshu first describe it, It was sort of like looking through a window, where you have different elements of the frame, and the two people can look at each other through the window. And one element was the 94 calls to action of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. One element was the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Third, very importantly, was Section 35 of the Canada Act 1982, which recognized and affirmed pre-existing Aboriginal and treaty rights and responsibilities. And then the fourth, in this case, because we're looking at CBD, was the actual CBD, Convention on Biological Diversity, which is an international treaty. So conventions are multilateral. These are multilateral environmental agreements. And so when you frame it out like that, Crowshoe was saying, we look at each other through that window in equality and say, okay, I have something to bring to the table. And Western science has something to bring to achieve those outcomes. And so ethical space creates a fair playing ground, you know, for lack of a better term, for these knowledge systems to coexist in equality and be employed in the collective well-being for both parties, kind of a deal. Ethical space is sometimes related to so-called two-eyed seeing. And, you know, I want to acknowledge Albert Marshall and his wife, who's passed away now, but from Mi'kmaq country, that two-eyed seeing is looking at the world through two different lenses, one the indigenous worldview and then the Western science worldview. Now, that's similar to ethical space, but it's nuanced in terms of, you know, perceiving the world through these different cultural lenses, whereas ethical space is a place where we're gonna agree to get along. And really, interestingly, at the end of the day, this harkens back to the original vision of what Canada was intended to be, which is a nation of peace and friendship, where Indigenous and European nations share ultimate sovereignty of this country and the lands. So that's my first crack at ethical space. What do you think, Sudhe?
Yeah, I think that's a very good way of bringing it up. It's a little bit like sitting together and not feeling like you're pushed away by the other person on the other side of the table. I think someone said that a few years ago. And it really, I felt like, oh, that's an easy way of putting it together. Like feeling, first of all, being protected by all these frameworks that Eli explained, like the CBD, like the UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration for the Rights of Indigenous People, all these like Section 35, these laws that exist to protect one another and the space that we are in. So it's in kind of thinking the jurisdiction that we exist in, right? That protects us and allows us to be here together and discuss and respecting what the other person has to bring, even if we don't understand it. This two-eyed seeing is just like a really interesting way of thinking about it, I think. The Indigenous knowledge systems and, I don't know, scientific, for the lack of a better word, because the Indigenous knowledge systems also come from the scientific method, if you get deep into it. They seem like anecdotes, but because they've been tested thousands of years, that's why they feel that way. But they each give you a vision of like what the world looks like. And we do need those pieces. We need the spirituality. We need the understanding of the land, the knowledge that has been accumulated over hundreds, even thousands of generations to exist, to care for this space. And I think we all kind of do exist in some sort of ethical space. Sometimes it's not very ethical at times, because there's like also these like unwritten laws that are not necessarily good. But this is about like respecting and understanding that the other person comes with the knowledge and with rights and responsibilities that they care for. And that's how we actually can get into consensus building in our decision-making and such, instead of just voting and like thinking of a quorum or whatever to make decisions. Just very interesting concept. But while I was talking about it, I really felt like there is this space coming over me of like all the jurisdictions. I found it really fascinating. I'm just going to add it here. Like I entered Canada. It was the first time I kind of like went to a new country to live in. And then I was just like kind of blown away by this concept that I just got a visa and a study permit to come here in 2007. I don't know anybody, which was a crazy notion for me that like walking down the street, there's like no chance of me meeting anyone. And I'm allowed to do all these things. I'm allowed to like go take all these classes and go to all these restaurants and like get hired and do. And it just sounded crazy. But this is like this, like these agreements that existed that gave me this right by this little piece of paper to be allowed to do all of these things here. And just remembering all of that really exists for everyone in a way. And if you are here, and this is another thing that really caught me, and I'm going to bring it up because I don't even know if it's related, but it's like these people come, immigrants, like I'm one of that people from that community from like the other side of the planet. And after 20 years, they've got their life together here. And I was like, why is it not happening for Indigenous people? Like, why is it that there's so many issues, like especially urban Indigenous people, like they just go through like really terrible situations, and there's this drug overuse and alcohol over like abuse and like all these issues that exist in the community, despite the care they have for one another and the sense of community they have. And then I realized it's just colonization took something from them. And there's that pain that is there. I'm sorry, Eli, I'm talking. I'm just, you're sitting here and talking like this. But it just, to me, that's like a pain that I want to bring it up, because when you see that pain happened and it's still present, and it's not a long time ago. We're talking about residential schools, not a very long time ago. The last one closed, you know, we were alive, right? And this is a pain people are carrying. And just pretending that didn't happen and just telling them, hey, get over it, it's just so wrong and unfortunate and impossible. That's why I just kind of want to bring this up. A part of ethical space is taking responsibility for the things that has brought us here. For me, this right that I received for, like, because I got paperwork to be in this country and have rights to live here. And settlers that their grandparents came here and built this life and contributed in building this society. We are all benefiting from that pain that Indigenous people endured. And we can't just ignore that and say, I didn't do it. I just got a paper and appeared here. Or my grandparents also worked for building this country, which is also true. But the fact is, there is a responsibility we all need to accept over what has happened here and be in this place. And we can't create ethical space if we are ignorant in our own being of feeling like, oh, I have the right because some jurisdiction give me a right. That jurisdiction also like took rights away from some people that really were the main right holders of this gorgeous, beautiful place. And we need that respect and we need that understanding to build this all together. I just keep talking from the heart and such. And there's a reason for that. I studied co-management. I've looked up on maybe thousands of case studies of co-management because I did a PhD that took 10 years. Wow. So I'm like, but I feel like, and this is a very complicated case. That's why I keep bringing this up because it can only resolve itself if we come from a responsibility-based thinking and being honest. And everybody just comes in this place doing a little prayer and being like, hey, don't forget the big pictures, but that the big picture is caring for this place and this land and for future generations.
Creator articulates our lives in different ways. You know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. That's kind of in summary. It was foreseen, this time of suffering and hardship. And I guess, you know, putting it in modern sense is like Gaza. You know, Donald Trump's talking about clearing out Gaza. I mean, you know, and then, you know, after they destroyed everything that was here, now you're left on the streets kind of a deal and suffering the way she described. But that was all foreseen. And so we're just like moving through it. And going back to ethical space, like Reg, the other thing I want to empathize with him, because I can only imagine, because in my own short life, I'm 44 years old. I've been invited onto so many committees, so many, you know, government programs I participate in, I contribute to, whatever. And partly what Reg, I think, was saying is like, okay, we invited him in to this, you know, Aichi Target 11 implementation, Canada Target 1, 17% protected areas. And he said, well, let's not recreate the wheel. We have all these foundational agreements and understandings that through the TRC, volumes and volumes and volumes of hours and months and years of people's lives went into contributing to the 94 calls to action, the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. So many people devoted their life to that. Section 35, you know, Elijah Harper, the constitutional train, all those people who made Section 35 possible. So in a way, it's like, okay, here comes another government program. You're inviting me to come and give my perspective on implementing Aichi Target 11. Well, did you read all these other things that I've already... Start there. Read that first, and then I'll talk to you. You know, anyways, it's like committee after committee after committee. And I think of Elmer Cruchane, late Elmer Cruchane. He sat so patiently with the Assembly of First Nations a Special Chiefs Committee on Acting on Climate Change and the Environment, the so-called ACE Committee. Elmer chaperoned us diligently, and he always patiently reminded us of the foundational teachings of the Peace and Friendship Treaties. So we can kind of get ahead of ourselves. And even in my own short life, I'm only 44 years old, you know, like circular economy, bioregional economy, all the new $50 words to describe basic common sense and how we do sound microeconomics. And so that's a part of it. And yeah, I mean, Sude raises a good point. And you know, I'll say this. Much of my young life, I lived with shame. I didn't even really understand it. But I lived with shame because of the color of my skin. It was brutal, violent, and negative, and whatnot. And there was a certain point in my early 20s, like maybe Ron Martin, I'll credit him. He said to me, I was 23 years old. He said, Eli, he says, you know what? You're not an Indian. You're not a 6'1 or a 6'2. You're not First Nations. You're not Aboriginal. You're not Native. You're not Indigenous. He said, you're Kuas. And in our language, Kuas means real live human being. And it cuts through all those labels. It cuts through all that BS, you know, all that negativity in what we are as human beings. And I started to wear my scars with more pride after that, you know, going from living shame to living a life of pride more. And recognizing that all those hardships was preparing me, you know, articulating my life, articulating my spirit and my perspective such that I could serve the greater good of humanity, you know. You know, because there's only one way to learn that stuff. You can't learn it in a textbook. You can't learn it from a podcast. Thanks for the work you guys do, by the way. But you live it through the trials and tribulations and through the hardships of real life experiences. You know, the positive side is that despite all those hardships, our people still remember those foundational teachings, like Hishuk Ishtsawak. You know, everything is one and everything is interconnected. Khoi Kwiksup. I was just meeting with this new friend of mine, Jurgen. His uncle was Heisenberg, Principles of Uncertainty, and looking at quantum physics is just now starting to understand what Indigenous peoples have known for since time immemorial. And those teachings are still alive. My uncle Moses and Levi, they still are fluent speakers. And all that knowledge is still there. despite the genocide, despite residential schools, despite all that hardship, we still know who we are. We still know those foundational teachings. And that what IPCAs can offer the world today is the olive branch to the dominant self-destructive society to see how we can live better with each other, but also with Mother Nature Creator's jurisdiction. In 2010, I was invited to a conference in Palo Alto, California, of all places. And the name of the conference was called Paying Poseidon, the Greek god of the ocean. And the subtitle was The Emergence of Blue Carbon, or the Role of Marine Ecosystems in Serving the Economy. Off the coast of Tanzania, there's a community where they have a beautiful coral reef. And this civil society organization has been conserving this coral reef. And basically what they did is they provided a business case of how does that natural asset serve the local economy. A lot of people think snorkelers, you know, people who travel from abroad and they go and they swim and they look at the coral reef and they... But the coral reef actually provides so many other benefits to the local ecology and the local economy. And so they quantified that. And then they said, okay, if we don't take care of the coral reef, what happens is that it will die. And when a coral reef dies, it hardens, calcifies. And so a healthy living coral reef fluctuates with the power of the ocean. It moves ever so gently. And when it dies, though, it hardens and then it becomes brittle. And then the power of the ocean slowly but surely breaks down the coral reef. And now you no longer have that habitat protection for the mangroves, which gives habitat for little baby fish and feeds the local fishery, and erosion control for the beaches. All that starts to break down now. And so they successfully argued with the local business community to have an ecosystem service fee for that coral reef. And I, at the time, I do not work for my nation today. My nation is Tloquid First Nation, New Chanoth Nation on the west coast of Vancouver Island. I do not work for my nation today. I'm not a political representative. I have hereditary rights and responsibilities, and I'm a Musqueam, and I come from Witwak. But at the time, I was an employee, so I brought home this concept of coral reef conservation and payment for ecosystem services to my own community, where we had these massive trees that the local tourism sector was benefiting from. The local tourism sector in Tofino was benefiting from the conservation that our nation had been doing since time immemorial, but more pointedly since 1984, the Mears Island Tribal Park Declaration, 1985, the Mears Island court case. There's a huge amount of money and effort that was invested in protecting those trees. Those trees, are, for all intents and purposes, are the coral reefs, you know, the natural assets that not only bring visitors from around the world, but also filter water and provide clean drinking water to the district of Tofino. I brought that concept home from Palo Alto and with the Small Boat Operators Association, and they agreed 100% they should be paying an ecosystem service fee for benefiting from those ancient cedar rainforests. And that, for me, is the thin edge of the wedge. I believe that we can do the same thing in the Capital Regional District of Victoria, and we can do the same thing here. So what can people in False Creek, if you care and love about this place, I think people should be paying an ecosystem service fee. And I would say 1-3% of every financial transaction. And this is not a tax. This can be seen as an investment. With the ecosystem service, you can say, all right, we're going to actually improve the ecological integrity of this watershed. And we can demonstrate. We'll show you. Zita Cobb is one of my new role models. She's from the East Coast, Fogo Island. Zita Cobb, Shorefast Foundation. They have this really cool system. Like when you go to the grocery store and you buy like a product, they have a nutritional breakdown of what's in it, your zinc or your daily, whatever, saturated fats or whatever. And she has this idea of doing an economic nutrition list. So every time you spend a dollar, we should show where does that money go to? And the same thing can be done here for with ecosystem services and supporting the nation, not only here to improve the ecological integrity at False Creek and Vancouver, but within their territories, which are much broader, which is where, you know, people derive their drinking water and, you know, all the things that make life possible. Even though False Creek, probably to some people's minds, it's like so urbanized and so cemented. As Sude talked about the beautiful life under there, it gave me a really nice visual. But people are like, well, that's the city, you know. But because of all the traffic that comes through here, all the people that are living here and come visitors from other countries that come through here, there's an opportunity to showcase and to convey not necessarily, yes, the good, the bad, and the ugly, but the teachings that are still alive of this Skokomish and the, you know, Coast Salish peoples that are actually fundamental to the long-term survival of humankind. So I think that False Creek and the people here, in addition to supporting the local ecological integrity, can become a beacon and a place to showcase what the conservation efforts that are happening throughout the rest of British Columbia, and to collect an ecosystem service fee that will provide the energy needed to mobilize IPCAs throughout this province.
So if I were to maybe engage you, Eli, in a thought experiment as to what an IPCA here in an urban marine setting like False Creek might look like, what would it take to sort of set that up? Who would need to be involved?
Yeah, the question brings me back to a conference that we had in Montreal. I think it was 2010 or something like this. And there was a lady, she was doing a presentation on urban biosphere reserves. So I think this is a good approximation or a good reference point. A biosphere reserve, if you don't know, is part of the so-called Man in the Biosphere program of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. It's supposed to be focused on peace building. And biosphere reserves, the Man in the Biosphere program, we have 19, maybe 20 biosphere reserves in Canada, and there's many biospheres around the world. And she was proposing that we do an urban biosphere reserve. And this actually upset a lot of people. And what was interesting, and I was initially a little confused myself personally. Well, how can you do a biosphere reserve in an urban setting? But her argument was so on point. She said, you know, like given the trends with ecological integrity, climate change, whatnot, here, all the values that we aspire to, the Man the Biosphere program, if you just do it out in the rural areas where there's not a lot of people, that's easy. Doing it where there's a high concentration of people, that's where we need to get it right. She won me over in 5 minutes. And I think the same goes for IPCAs. People might think, oh, because actually the Canadian government, they're trying to achieve their commitments to the UN Convention on Biological Diversity. By the way, we haven't even hit 17% yet. And now we're supposed to do 25 by 25,
yeah,
30 by 30. But the way that the knee-jerk reaction, the instinct, is to do it in vast open spaces where nobody lives. It's easier to create a protected area out there, right? Well, I think the challenge and the opportunity in False Creek is to actually do it where it's most importantly done, in highly populated areas. That's where we need to emulate those teachings. I think back to Tundi Agardi. Tundi wrote the book on ocean zoning. She's a professor from the University of Miami. And I had the opportunity to meet her when she was on a talking tour at the University of Victoria, probably 2010. It all goes back there. And she's a hard scientist. Like she's that's what she went to school for. That's what she studies. That's what she does. She said to me, because she did her PhD work around the Mediterranean Sea. And she said, you know, the irony or the unexpected thing is that the science is really straightforward. It's getting all those people who live around the sea to get to talk to each other and to actually get along. That's the hardest part. And she said, that's where we need social scientists. And yes, the harder you draw the lines on the maps, the more difficult it gets. And I guess if I could summarize all that up, if I sit here and say, I have more rights than you, you have less rights than me. That means you're not as important as I am. That's kind of like fighting words in some places, right? But if I say we have shared responsibility, you have responsibilities, I have responsibilities. We all have shared responsibilities about this place. Then you start to bring people together. If you start off with rights, and by the way, the rights-based conversation is 100% important. I don't want to steal anything away from that. But what my elders have encouraged me to do is to have a responsibilities-based dialogue. So if you have all those different interested groups and you come together, and if you start with rights, generally it goes to an adversarial position. And sometimes it goes to court, which is the ultimate adversarial playground. But if you have a responsibilities-based conversation, then you bring people together and they have a better probability of collaborating successfully.
But also I feel I want to talk about Chief Marilyn Baptiste, and she brought this up so much and she talks about it a lot, that we need to have areas for people to connect to nature in the cities. And because that's kind of like where most people live, a lot of people live in the cities, and they all need that connection to Mother Earth and to nature. And the modern human really is taken away from what really is life. And we need that. And so that's why it's actually really important. It's more important to have these places be protected. The city Eli mentioned is one of the places that so many visitors come. And this is a place we can showcase other IPCAs that exist in Canada and in British Columbia, showcase Indigenous knowledge. This is a really special opportunity here. We add life to this gorgeous life that exists here. I feel that culture, Indigenous culture, the culture of this land is going to make it so much more beautiful. People of the city also really need to be connected to the land. Not just it's more difficult and challenge and be up for the challenge. It's what we need. It's one of our rights and one of our responsibilities, for sure.
Thank you. Thank you again to the both of you. Really, really appreciate having you here.
Yeah.
Water Bodies is a production of the False Creek Friends Society. Please help spread the word and get involved. False Creek could use your help. Subscribe to our newsletter at falsecreekfriends.org for the latest news and volunteer opportunities. And what do you want to see in False Creek? You can leave us a comment. Water Bodies is a video podcast on YouTube and Spotify, and an audio podcast everywhere else. We'll see you next time.